Hello and welcome to episode 31 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and will use it to be wrong on the internet. I am, as ever, that bored man, and my name, as ever, is Graham Lee. So in this episode, the topic is Apple CPU transitions throughout history, because we're in the middle of their latest, though I expect not their last, CPU transition. We're far enough along it. This is the Mac CPU transition from Intel x86-64 to ARM 64. We'll come back to that one much later in the episode because I'm going to take these in chronological order. It's going fairly well, and so let's sort of look at the earlier ones and draw some parallels. Now, the first transition Apple made, which I think is probably the longest transition in terms of the time between starting to sell the new CPU family and stopping selling products based on the old CPU family, is the 6502 to Motorola 68K transition. Now, the MOS technology 6502 was the CPU of choice for the Apple One and the Apple II and its successors. And if you take into account the fact that it was made by a different vendor but was still a 6502 compatible CPU, then also the Apple III as well. And it was a popular choice for many 8-bit micros. 6502 was itself a sort of cheaper, simplified implementation of the Motorola 6800 series, and there were other vendors who used the 6502 and the 6800 collection of processors. And the other popular choice was, again, two companies where one made a sort of cheaper or like advanced or whatever different implementation of the same CPU, the Intel 8080 being the base design and the Zilog Z80 being the often preferred implementation of it. So you have basically these sort of two competing CPU families during the 8-bit microcomputer era. And I'm not saying that that was the entire of the market. I'm saying that those were the two popular choices. Now, if you are Apple, you notice that Commodore, your rival, and indeed the maker of the Commodore 64, which some people still claim is the most popular model of personal computer ever sold, have bought MOS. So Commodore owns your CPU supplier. Your competitor owns your CPU supplier. Imagine if Google bought ARM today, what Apple would do about it. So, yeah, this was a difficult position for Apple to be in. And also, the 6502 never really had any sort of forward path. MOS made an improved version, the 6510, but because they were owned by Commodore, it only ever got used in the Commodore 64. There was, a second manufacturer who made a 16-bit sort of enhanced version of the 6502, which got used in the Apple IIgs and in the Super Nintendo, which brought the platforms forward a bit, but didn't kind of make them competitive with other processors that were out at the time, and didn't allow them to implement the kinds of application features that people were getting used to from other platforms. And so this never really represented a sort of strategic migration option for Apple. As I say, they did use the Western Design Center, the nicely succinctly named WDC65C816 in the Apple IIgs, but the IIgs kind of came out after the 68K transition had already started. In fact, like I said, I think this is the longest, most drawn out transition that they had from the 6502 to its replacement, the 68000, the Motorola CPU series, because the first 68K based computer that Apple came up with was the Lisa, which was released in 1983. And the Apple II GS, which was the last of the 6502 systems, was discontinued in 1992. Now, so that means that this was a 9-year-long CPU family transition. Now, it is possible that, in fact, you know, Apple was selling sort of Apple II cards for Macintoshes in the 90s, and you know, for a few years after the 2GS was discontinued. So it is possible to argue that actually this transition lasted even longer than that. I'm not going to bother making that argument. I think the reasons we'll see later, the reasons why the other transitions were much faster, was partly emulation. The CPUs that Apple were moving to were able to emulate the instructions and thus the applications of the existing architecture at roughly comparable speeds. Obviously, Apple always claim that they're faster, but you know, I think roughly comparable is a good enough statement to make from a sort of dispassionate perspective. And also, Apple weren't also changing the operating system and the capabilities of the computer. You know, the Lisa or the Macintosh is a very different thing from an Apple II, whereas an Intel Mac is a Mac, and a Power Mac is a Mac, and a Quadra is a Mac. You know, they're kind of keeping the basic computer experience the same and just swapping CPUs out. So, the next thing we come to is we're in the 68000 era. We'll leave the we'll leave the Lisa behind. By the way, I didn't mention the Apple III. That did use the 6502B CPU. So we'll leave 6502s behind. We'll leave the Apple Lisa behind and look at the Mac. Now, the Motorola 68000, the series of CPUs that powered the first few iterations of the Mac hardware, was designed to be a Unix CPU. Mac OS is very much not a Unix. For example, the 68K processors have two modes. They have supervisor mode and user mode, which differ in how you're allowed to access the I/O facilities. That means that you can have a kernel that has arbitration over how the devices on the computer are accessed, and you have user space programs that have to make requests to the kernel in order to like do I/O, in order to use like the terminal or the serial port or you know, the GUI or whatever. But macOS didn't use those facilities. Essentially, the entire of macOS ran in supervisor mode, which is one of the things that led to some of the stability issues. Not all of them, because like the Amiga OS did run in, did understand this kind of two-stage mode. It had the exec kernel and it had the user space applications. But you could still do like memory writes anywhere. And so you could still like, you know, trash the operating system's understanding of what state the computer was in from an errant application. But it did offer sort of some protections. And macOS got a reputation as being unstable because of the fact that all of these applications were running in supervised mode. And it made the multi-finder, so it made multitasking on 68K Macs very difficult to implement, because you couldn't make any assumptions about what an application was doing. It was basically taking control of the whole computer. So a lot of the sort of multi-finder code had kind of special case. Okay, so Photoshop does this weird thing where it directly accesses the frame buffer, and we need to like look to see whether the app that's running is Photoshop and then deal with the frame buffer in a special way before we switch to Word, which is going to do a different special thing with the computer, and so on. Also, a lot of CPU features are now commonplace across processor families and architectures appeared during the lifetime of the Motorola 68000 series. So integrated FPU, generally after the 68020, so in the 030 and above, there was like a full fat version which had an FPU on board, and then there was an LC low cost or EC, which I imagine stood for the economic cost or something, reduced versions that didn't have these facilities. And if you wanted to use floating point instructions, you had to have a second chip, similar to the Intel 386SX and 386DX or 486SX and DX. So the integrated FPU came along during the lifetime of the 68K series. Superscalar execution and instruction pipelines came along during this CPU family. Integrated memory management units. In fact, the original 68000 didn't work with memory management units at all. It was the 010, which was the first one that supported them. Large caches. So the idea that there would be memory on the chip that wasn't for the register file, it wasn't for storing the accumulators and the stack pointers and so on. It was a cache of the instructions and data that were being read into the CPU during execution of the program. All of these things came along during the development of this CPU family, which means that operating systems that were there when they started using the first generation, the 68000, like macOS and Amiga OS, didn't use any of those features natively, because they either had to run all the way back to the 68K, or they had accumulated what you might call technical debt, or you might just call historic design decisions from this earlier stage of development of the family. So the software on the, if you look at a Quadra or some mythical Mac that was running a 68060, it would not use all of the features of the CPU. And so it would be slower than the same software that was targeting that CPU directly. But of course, if it targeted that CPU directly, it either had to be bigger because it had instructions for the older processors and the current one, or it had to not work on the older processors, both of which involve trade-offs. So the 68K CPU series was not comparable in performance with processors from the rest of the market. The 68060, which was an incredibly expensive CPU, which is why I didn't really see it in too many computers, it was mostly sold as sort of third-party accelerator boards, was kind of comparable with a Pentium, except for weird things related to floating point maths. And it's very hard to go into this because it's quite a complex situation. The Motorola chip, the 68060, could always issue a floating point instruction at any point during decoding any other instruction. So whatever was going on in the superscalar pipeline, the next instruction could be a floating point instruction. The Pentium couldn't. The Pentium's FPU was not pipelined, which meant that if the next instruction to come up was a floating point instruction and the CPU wasn't in the one state where it was possible for that to happen, you got a pipeline stall, and everything that was currently going on would have to get to an end before that floating point instruction could be issued. But it was much faster at executing floating point instructions. What this means is that code where you didn't particularly optimize for the platform would be faster on the 68060, but code that was well designed would be much, much faster on the Pentium. And really, That was on, like, comparing with the very first generation of Pentiums, the 60 megahertz chips. By the time you got up to the 9100 megahertz chips, Motorola just couldn't keep up. Now, Motorola had a plan for this, and it was the 88K series, which was a RISC CPU. RISC was the new hotness at the beginning of the 90s. These were supposed to be, as the name suggests, reduced instruction set computing. The idea was that you could focus on making a simpler collection of instructions that could be executed a lot faster than the sort of complex and rich set of instructions that came with legacy designs like the Intel CPU family. Ironically, Motorola's 88K was actually so complex that you couldn't implement it on a single chip. So they had to have two chips for their RISC CPU, and it was incredibly expensive, very high performance. It was only really sold to high-end vendors, and companies like Next and Apple like evaluated it and didn't adopt it. Most OEMs didn't adopt it, and so it kind of failed in the marketplace. And Motorola, seeing that the writing was on the wall, joined Apple in tying their horse to the IBM cart. IBM had a CPU that was used in their RS6000 series of like workstations and Unix computers called the RISC single chip. And Motorola and Apple and IBM worked together on turning this into a scalable instruction set that would work for everything from like massive mainframes down to workstation grade and personal computer grade sort of desktop systems. And that was the thing that became the PowerPC. So the PowerPC, the 601, the original chip, the performance in comparison with the 68000 was, and the high-end 68000s at that, was such that if you had a like one of the fastest Mac 68K boxes, the Quadras, and then you ran the same software emulated on the PowerPC, it would be a bit slower, but it would still be usable. If you had one of the earlier generations of Macs, then your software could well be faster. And that's why, you know, I say that Apple market the emulation as faster, and I say roughly the same, because you've got to work out exactly what you're comparing when you make those kinds of statements. What this meant was that Apple didn't have to go to the work of porting everything to the PowerPC before they could launch the first Power Macs. They had to provide an emulator and then run macOS and all of the user applications in that emulator, and most people who hadn't bought the most expensive Quadras would still get a better performance. So people who are on like Macintosh 2s would still get a better performance out of a Power Mac than they did out of a Macintosh 2, despite the fact that mostly what the Power Mac was being used for was to emulate a Macintosh 2. That was the thing that made this transition from Motorola 68000 to PowerPC so much more rapid than the 6502 to Motorola 68000 transition. So the Power Mac started shipping in March 1994. Remember, this is only like under 2 years after the 2GS, after the last 6502 based system was terminated. So March 1994, they started shipping Power Macs, and they cancelled the Quadra in October 1995. So this is a year and a half transition, as compared with the like nearly 10-year transition we had in the previous generation. Quick aside on the transition from PowerPC to PowerPC and Intel. When Apple started using the Next Step software platform, they released the operating system on both Intel and PowerPC. And this was true of the Rhapsody developer previews and the OpenDarwin Unix distribution, which sort of paralleled the use of Darwin in the early versions of Mac OS X from like 10.0 to about 10.2 or 3. Apple themselves, of course, never released an Intel-based computer at this time and never officially supported this their software on the Intel platform. So this is kind of a fake transition. Also, IBM had a PowerPC chip called the PowerPC 615 that actually included an x86 CPU on the die, and you could issue PowerPC 32 or 64-bit instructions or x86 instructions that could be executed by the same processor, and Apple never used that CPU. There's also, mixed up in all of this story, there's the mythical Star Trek project, which was supposed to be a port of the original Macintosh OS to Intel. Now, I know nothing about that, apart from having read of its existence in various business case studies of Apple from the period. So we're going to leave that one there and say that Apple's PowerPC to PowerPC and Intel transition never succeeded, and they went back to being a PowerPC only shop until the next transition came along, which was the PowerPC to PowerPC 64 transition with the IBM 970 series CPUs, which Apple marketed as the G5, which was a bit rude because the GN naming was Motorola's naming for their CPUs in development. And while Apple and Motorola agreed on what the G3 and the G4 were, Motorola had the codename G5 for their next generation of CPUs, and then Apple just like pinched it and used it for the IBM CPUs that they started selling. Now, technically, the PowerPC 64 is not a separate architecture because the PowerPC instruction set architecture defines both 32-bit and 64-bit addressing modes and instructions, like sort of mathematical operations on 64-bit wide registers. But many CPUs didn't include the 64-bit capabilities, including all of the Motorola ones that Apple used and all of the AIM Alliance, like the PrEP CPUs that Apple used in the Power Macs. That's not to say that IBM weren't making 64-bit PowerPCs before the G5. In fact, they were doing it before the G3, but Apple just weren't using any of them. So technically, there wasn't ever a transition from PowerPC to PowerPC 64 because, in a like very pedantic sense, they are the same architecture, just Apple were using hobbled chips. And, of course, Apple never actually transitioned to PPC 64. They did sell computers based on the 970, the PowerMac G5 and the Xserve G5, but they sold them alongside PowerBooks and PowerMacs that, and the Xserve for that matter, that had the Motorola 7400 series, so the G4 CPUs, the 32-bit systems. So this was another abortive transition that never fully materialized. And of course, that was the reason that Apple gave, as a reason Steve Jobs gave anyway, for doing the for reals transition from PowerPC to Intel 32-bit. Now, I was there. I was at that WWDC 2005 where Steve Jobs got on the stage and had the big slide that said it's true, and had Paul Ottolini in the bunny suit invited onto the stage to kind of symbolically hand over the first wafer of Intel CPUs for Apple. Obviously, they already had a bunch of Macs running Intel. They weren't going to go and carve a CPU out of this silicon wafer and then check whether all their software worked. I actually didn't believe it at the time. And I think the reason for this was that Apple had been very vociferous in their marketing, particularly John Rubinstein had been very vociferous in his technical discussions as well as the marketing discussions about the fact that the PowerPC was a superior architecture to Intel and that it was a faster CPU and a better CPU. So I kind of thought, yeah, that this was a hollow rumor that Apple would probably just like kind of carry on iterating on the the PowerPC architecture, but of course they'd kind of burnt some bridges with Motorola by this point, and had made marketing promises that depended on IBM being able to deliver CPUs that IBM didn't deliver. Notice I didn't say IBM couldn't deliver, which was Apple's argument at the time. Apple said that IBM were unable to deliver a 3 gigahertz G5 chip or make the power envelope suitable for laptop use. It is highly likely that Apple's Mac business at the time was just too small for IBM to want to spend any decent amount of money on doing that development. And that it's not that IBM couldn't do it, it's that IBM chose not to do it. Nonetheless, for whatever reason, IBM did not do it. And so there was no G5 PowerBook and there was no 3 gigahertz Power Mac. They got very close. I think there was like a 2.9, but it needed this weird liquid cooling system because it ran so hot. And so, this thing did actually happen. There was the transition to 32-bit Intel. And famously, Apple said that it would take 2 years from WWDC 2005, and it actually took one-ish. They announced the Mac Pro and Xserve at WWDC 06, but you couldn't buy them then. And there was more than a year's gap between 05 and 06. And again, the rate of change here, the ability to deliver that quickly on the transition was due to emulation. And the fact that the Intel CPUs could run PowerPC code at what I'm going to call comparable speed with the actual PowerPC hardware. Also helped, I think, by the fact that the sort of developer landscape was very simple at the time, and Apple simplified it even harder in making this transition. Cocoa was Apple owned technology that was based on OpenStep, which is a cross platform layer anyway. Carbon was Apple owned technology. Java was being maintained, but the port of Java, at least for Mac OS X, was being maintained with significant Apple input, and so they were able to stand that up very quickly and spend their own time in advance doing it. And then they told everybody else, if you're not using our tools and our compilers, switch to using our tools and our compilers, and then you'll be able to make this code change work. The description in WWDC was, if you are using Xcode, press this checkbox and you will have an app. Or at least if you're using Xcode and CoCoA, check this box, then you'll have an Intel app or a universal app. If you are using Xcode and Carbon, check this box. Do a little bit of porting work to make sure that you're not relying on anything that's PowerPC specific, and then you'll have an app. And if you're, and they actually named a competitor at this point, but if you're doing something else, then switch to Xcode and then check this box. And that's a position that Apple just aren't in anymore. So I was a little put out by Apple switching to 32-bit Intel in 2005, because it was clear that they were going to have to switch again to 64-bit Intel very, very soon. In fact, if you look at the landscape of Apple's hardware, they already had 64-bit CPUs. They already had G5s, IBM 970 CPUs in their high-end desktop and server products, and now they were going back to 32-bit CPUs in these. So there was going to have to be another transition, and that was the i386 to what's now called x86-64. It was actually originally AMD's EM64T instruction set, which Intel soon adopted when it became clear that it was winning over the Intel Architecture 64, which was the Itanium series of CPUs. So having announced the transition from PowerPC to Intel 32-bit in 2005 and effectively more or less completed it by the end of 2006 anyway, the first 64-bit kernel in the first version that would boot of macOS 10 that would boot natively on an x86-64 box came in 2009, and the first 64-bit only build of macOS 10 came in 2011. So it took 2 years to do the Intel 32-bit to Intel 64-bit transition, despite it having only taken 1 year to do the PowerPC to Intel 32-bit transition. There's no particular reason for that other than the fact that it just wasn't that urgent, because the 64-bit CPUs could all run the 32-bit code. So it was similar to that 68K to PPC transition, where you had you could just run all of your old software on the newer computers, and it would just be faster because those computers were faster, so you didn't need to port all of the software forwards. They could do it purely in software release management rather than in tandem hardware and software release schedules. And so there was no urgency and it took a little bit longer. And that brings us up to nearly the present day. It brings us up to WWDC last year and the Intel 64 to ARM 64 transition, because by 2011, all macOS 10 builds were 64-bit only. So, definitely long before 2020. And now we're in the middle of the ARM transition. It's going about the same rate as the previous couple of transitions that we've looked at. It's being helped by the fact that Apple have already been running their operating system on ARM 64 for years in the form of the iPad and the iPhone and the Apple TV. So there's no sort of software engineering urgency from Apple's side for the most part. Obviously, a lot of the sort of AppKit stuff needed to be ported, and the applications. But we had mostly, as developers, learned not to deal with the CPU, not to deal with knowledge of the CPUs in our Mac applications during the PPC to Intel transition. So there probably wasn't as much work doing that port of macOS 10's user space from Intel 64-bit to ARM 64-bit as there had been in going from PowerPC to Intel. But I'll look at this in more detail in a couple of minutes. Because first, I want to compare the state of the transition, being sort of 11 months into it now. Apple did basically the same thing in 2005 as they did in 2020. They said, we've got this thing, we're going to be releasing computers based on it soon. There is a developer transition kit that if you are... if you need to make sure that your software runs on the new Macs, then you can insert a word that might mean something between buy and rent and borrow and loan or something like that. Our developer transition kit, and test it out, and then you'll be ahead of the curve. And they did that, and then a few months later started shipping the first models, and then within a year had stuff on, you know, had like Macs for sale that were the new thing. So it's very similar in that regard, but bear in mind that so going from one WWDC to the next, and admittedly, the WWDC 2006 was late. They typically run in June, and that one was in August, so there was like a 14-month gap. But like that's a 14-month gap from saying there is a transition kit that developers can borrow slash buy slash loan slash whatever to we have now announced the final Macs and like the entire range has been transitioned. Lol, some of them are only pre-order. The state of the M1 transition is, if anything, slightly behind that for the moment. Now, obviously, we know that WWDC 21 is going to be in June, so that only gives them 12 months, so we're only 11 months into that 12-month period. And the DTKs have all gone back, and the hardware has come out, the actual products based on the ARM64 CPUs, but they are only a subset. So there's still the 16-inch MacBook Pro, the 27-inch iMac, and the Mac Pro, all still being sold with the Intel CPU. Whereas before, there are only two models, the Mac Pro and the Xserve, and you could kind of argue that the Xserve was such a niche like appliance that it doesn't really count. I'm not going to do that. So there are three models, a laptop, a desktop, and a workstation in the current transition that still haven't moved over to the new architecture. Whereas at this time-ish, in 2006, there were two models, the workstation and the server. And the developer experience has been mixed. Like some, in some ways, it has been better than the experience of the PowerPC to Intel transition, in that we all already learned, because of that transition, not to depend on information about specifics of the CPU, things like byte ordering, structure size, and indeed the Swift language doesn't really expose that stuff unless you go into the Here Be Dragons unsafe area of it. You know, I have a story from that sort of 2005-06 transition era where one of my users came to me with some astrophysics code that he was working on and had been working on for a very long time, and he said it works on that Mac and on that Mac, and it doesn't work on that Mac, and all the numbers come out wrong. And I said, oh yes, so that Mac is the new Intel one, and those Macs are the PowerPC ones, and so my expectation is that your code depends on the endianness, on the order in which bytes are stored in memory when they represent a larger number, like a word. And this turned out to be the case. So we had a conversation. I explained what big endian and little endian are, and you know, the problems of depending on the order in which the the bytes are stored in a word. And he understood that, said thank you, went away, worked on his code, came back like a couple of days later and said, now my code works on that Mac and it doesn't work on those Macs. We've moved forward from that because we all understood that situation was problematic for us the first time we did this port. On the other hand, from a developer's perspective, Apple has way less control of the widget now than they did back in the 2005 days. And you saw that in their WWDC announcements when they were careful to talk about all of the third-party framework vendors that they'd worked with to make sure that all of their code ran well on the new Macs. You know, if you look at like the 2005 WWDC talk, you see people like Wolfram saying, look, we managed to build Mathematica for Intel Mac and it didn't take us very long and it runs really fast. And that's unsurprising because like Mathematica came to Mac OS X from NextStep, where it had supported four different architectures, including Intel 32-bit. It's unsurprising that like that their code base was still fairly portable and didn't have too much like porting effort involved. But in this one, in this transition, you saw them saying, and we've worked with the developers of the Unity framework to make sure that all of your apps are going to work on this new Mac. And you know, with various other technology vendors, you know, there are Unity applications, there are Electron applications, and so on. And that makes it a much more complex ecosystem. One of the projects I work on relies very heavily on Docker. And Docker for the Apple Silicon Macs, the ARM 64-bit Macs, came out way after the ARM 64-bit Mac did. So I've had a Mac on my desk since like late last year that I haven't been able to work on one of my projects on because it uses technology that that not only doesn't work or didn't until very recently work on that computer, but that was outside of Apple's control. And so they were dependent on third parties enabling like developer experiences for their platform. That's a very different experience from the experience of writing software on the 2005, 2006 Macs, where you were either doing Cocoa or Carbon, which were both Apple technologies, or PowerPlant, which Apple were keen to shoot in the head and so did so very publicly during the description of the transition, or you were just doing fairly stock Unix stuff like Python or TCL scripts, which were very portable anyway because they were ported to all different Unixes as well as all different CPU architectures. But again, because of the emulation story, the user experience has mostly been okay, unless the users were depending on the apps that had to wait for the framework vendors, sort of platform vendors, to support this new hardware. Once again, Apple can say this new CPU can emulate the old CPU at comparable speeds, therefore you can just carry on running all of your old software. So the next time that there is an Apple CPU transition, and I expect that to be in about 10 to 15 years, transitioning from ARM 64 to RISC-V 64, the next time there is that transition, you can expect that the same thing will happen again. The transition will occur once emulating the ARM instructions on the new hardware is comparable to running it on the native hardware. As ever, I enjoy talking about this stuff. You can probably tell by the length of time I've waffled on it tonight. Please do get in touch to talk about this. You can email me, grahamlee@acm.org. You can reply to the post on sicpers.info, where this podcast is hosted. Thank you very much for listening. I will talk to you again soon.